artist Bethany Collins is obsessed with words, and her latest word is blue. Blue is explored in her new exhibit called With Exception of the Sky. It's at the Hudgens Center, and it marks a year since Bethany won the Hudgens Prize, a $50,000 grant awarded biennially to a Georgia artist. Producer Gabby Watts spoke with Bethany about how financial comfort has changed her life as an artist.
So since winning the Hudgens, I've kept in touch with some of the jurors and I've met with them, and that kind of relationship has continued, which actually has been really helpful. But the prize itself has allowed me to just continue my practice and being a full-time artist. I was teaching up until a couple years ago when I got the Studio Museum residency. I was teaching full-time at a little technical college in town, and it was 6 classes every semester, so it was a lot. And it was art appreciation, so I was teaching, you know, I was like saying the same thing 6 times a week, and it was rewarding, but it was a lot to do that and then keep my practice. So the Studio Museum, and then followed by residencies, followed by the Hudgens, just the financial stability of that has allowed me to continue being a full-time working artist.
I remember reading one Tennessee Williams essay when he said when he did get financial success, he found he went into complacency more so than production. So I hope that hasn't been the case for you.
No, but you know, when I got to the Studio Museum, I'd come from teaching so often. And then going from that kind of situation into being in my studio all the time was a really big adjustment. It's just yourself and it's just you holding you accountable. And that kind of freedom of my time was really it was a completely different relationship to my work and to my like way of thinking about making.
And have you found yourself entering different art circles that you haven't been familiar with before?
I mean, going to New York, that feels like a jumping from Atlanta to New York, and then from New York to Omaha to the Bemis Center, and then to Miami to the Fountainhead, to McDowell in New Hampshire. All of those places feel like very distinct art communities with each of their own kind of positives and challenges. But meeting artists in all of those different places has been probably the most beneficial thing about making that transition from teaching to being full-time, because there's no way to know how that's going to affect your work until you're in it.
So how has it affected your work?
Well, when I got to the Studio Museum, I would say that's the greatest shift in my work. Prior to that, I was making these white noise pieces, which were chalk on chalkboard. And they started when I was in grad school. I was making kind of grad school work that was already trying to talk about ideas of race and identity, but maybe not so successfully. And the critiques that I was, you know, started to get were much more about the speaker's attempt to understand something about my racial identity than they were about the actual work that I was making. And so I took that language and made that the work. But when I got to the Studio Museum, you know, that work that got me to that place didn't feel necessary anymore. It felt as though I'd solved the question that the series began with, my own kind of personal question. And so being in that space and being challenged by that space and having a lot more eyes and kind of pressure on me and the work, it gave me the room to end that series and feel like I could let it go. And there would be something to come after. And since then, a lot more kind of space and ambiguity and uncertainty in a really satisfying way has entered my making. And I'm glad about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was really struck by your series on the Southern Review, where you're mm-hmm. taking journals and basically blocking out text as sort of a comment on race and language and erasure. And it seems with the series that you have up now at the Hudgens Center is doing a slightly similar thing, but you're not focusing on the Southern Review.
Yeah.
So what is this, the text that you found for this new exhibition? Where are those coming from?
It's actually from, so the largest piece in that show is a 29-part work. So it takes up a wall and a half of the space. And it's actually all the definitions from a 1953 dictionary for the color blue. So blue is never shown, but some of the definitions for the color, at least in that particular text, are puritanical, risque, baleful, a seed, a sailor. You know, words that when dissected don't give you the origin. And even when they're compiled back together, I don't think you'll ever get back to the color blue. And so the idea of that work actually came out of this text that I was reading through the language looking glass, something like that. It's about the evolution of the language of color. And so I think there was this 19th century theory that people, it was a more civilized, developed trait to be able to distinguish between colors. And so more primitive peoples, and that was the nicest term that they had for them, could not distinguish between, let's say, black and blue. Blue as well, and this theory actually still holds, is the last color for us to name. Like when, as language develops, that blue comes last. With the exception of the sky, then the theory is it happens so rarely in the natural world that there is no reason for us to create this other term. So the theory was, if you couldn't see the difference between these colors, you weren't as developed of a people. You weren't as civilized, you weren't as Western, and particularly European. So there was an anthropologist, psychiatrist, who went to, I think it was an island off the coast of Australia, to study these native people. And he developed this test that actually disproved the entire theory. They were absolutely able to distinguish between all of these different blues, and in particular between black and blue. They just didn't feel the need for the term, right? And so everything blue was just black. And so looking at the sky, it's black. Looking at the ocean, it's black. And so this relationship between black and blue is something I wanted to continue to tease out. Linguistically, poetically, there's already this beautiful intertwining of black and blue. And so that piece, I think, gets at both that relationship between the color, but then also our ability to see the same thing and perceive it differently. Or that if we don't have a name for a thing, if we don't name a thing, can we even see it to begin with? Mm-hmm. And there's something between those two questions that I think that work and the exhibition as a whole is trying to untangle.
Well, I was reading Arts ATL's piece that they did on you at the 30 Under 30 series a few years ago, and you were talking about the process of making the white noise chalk drawings. And it seemed that your in-studio process was very intensive of writing until your hands hurt, and then you didn't actually look at the full piece so that you wouldn't see it until it was fully realized. So for these pieces on the color blue now, and also now that you do have so much more time to be in your studio, has that actual physical process of making art changed, or is it still sort of hearkening back to what you're doing for those projects?
In some of the series, it continues. So the Contronym series, the works on paper, definitely involves my body very physically. And I think all the series, whether they involve my body and it's visible or not, there's a way in which they're all about making language manifest and physical within me, on me, and making that connection between my body and the language. But so the Contronym series, let's say, contronyms are words which contain their own opposites, and I started these in New York, and they're continuing. So quiddity is a beautiful example of a contronym. It's still my favorite. Quiddity is the essence of a thing and a trifling nothing. And over time, somehow absurdly, it's come to contain its own contradiction. That absurdity of language is just a gold mine for me conceptually, but also physically to make the works, I'm printing them on paper, I'm rewriting them in graphite, and then I'm using my spit to erase the text, and so that my spit eats into the paper and it falls and makes the language illegible except what I want you to be able to read. So it's very much about my kind of exertion of control over the language, very physically. Like my spit is all over that page. Not visibly, but it's there. But the newer work, like the piece I've done for the Birmingham Museum, is blind embossing. Blind embossing then is what's created is this kind of protrusion of the text from the surface of the paper. So it's very much like Braille. It has the quality and the very tactile quality of Braille. And so the text desires to be touched. But it's also a very clean process. I mean, there's no ink. My hand is no longer visible. And so that makes me uncomfortable artistically because it's unfamiliar terrain for me. The Southern Review, my fingerprints are all over it. I'm covered in charcoal by the time the piece is done. The White Noise series of chalk on chalkboard, I write the text until my hand hurts, and then I know that I've got to just let it go. the contronyms, my spit is on the surface of the page, literally erasing that text and controlling what you can read. The blind embossing, my hand is absent. The pieces at the Birmingham Museum, though, that process of my hand being absent fits conceptually because the works are about Birmingham News in 1963, made this very intentional choice not to place any stories that had to do with the civil rights movement, even if they were happening in Birmingham, on their cover page. When, you know, the Children's Day marches, the New York Times, all the other regional papers, a lot of the, you know, smaller, even local papers were publishing this information above the fold, front page, several images. But the Birmingham News was hiding that information a little bit further inside of the newspaper. And so the work then is very much about the absence of violence. And so the absence of my hand seems to work really well conceptually. But it makes me uncomfortable at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like there's no evidence of my body making manifest that language.
Well, I guess it's good to challenge yourself.
Maybe. We'll see.
Well, Bethany Collins, thank you so much for coming in and talking about your art.
My pleasure.